Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We broadcast all over the United States on different stations and all over the world, and we also try to look at what are the issues that are important to you, no matter what your background, ethnicity, your age, and we take all the information that you provide us, and we provide you with programming to match that. For example, you want to know about health? Well, we try to find always state-of-the-art, cutting-edge material. Today, we're going to talk about how a study finds medication errors, adverse drug events, in 1 out of every 2 surgeries. Who says so? Massachusetts General Hospital, published in the peer-reviewed journal Anesthesia. Also, low weight and high repetition exercise increases bone density, and that's important. What does it mean? I'll give you specifics so you can have stronger bones. For those of you who've been eating meat and think, well, it can't be that bad. If it were that bad, it would be banned. Not true. Remember cigarettes? Remember cyclamates, saccharin, and Agent Orange? Well, according to the latest study from the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer, quote, processed meats have the same cancer risks as cigarettes. Wow. Processed meats. That's the meat on pizzas. That's the meat in bologna. That's the meat in many of your hamburgers and hot dogs. I'll go into depth on that. Also, 2/3 of patients on antidepressants, that's a big number, by the way. We're talking about tens of millions of Americans. According to the latest study in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, are not depressed. Let me run that by you again. More than 2/3 of patients on antidepressants are not depressed. That's 69%. Well, why are they using them? Because these medications are extremely dangerous and are known to cause excessive paranoia, psychosis, homicidal tendency, suicidal ideation, and suicide. So I'll deal with that, and a lot more on health and healing. From our environmental segment, we have a big problem in dealing with mercury in a lot of the contaminants. Well, they've come up with a new way of dealing with mercury contamination from Finders University in Australia. They're using a polymer from lemons and oranges. Well, we've got a lot of that, so they're combining the two, the waste of the citrus fruit with mercury waste, and it's able to neutralize it. Also, there was a professor that received a large grant, $270,000, to study the human papillomavirus vaccine. Well, the person speaking out, and this is a major professor, and saying, I don't trust this vaccine. The evidence is not good. You rarely, if ever, have anyone in science that is receiving money speak out against the people who are giving them the money. I can assure you that person won't be long there. Early in the program, I'm going to give you a challenge to respond to. I'm going to share from Sam Jurens, America is a bomb waiting to explode. And Sam gives 4 reasons for this. I want you to think about what he is saying and then call in to see whether you agree or disagree with him or have something else to add to this, because I'll save my thoughts to afterwards. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor John Mutter. Professor Mutter is unusual in that he holds 2 distinctly different professorships at Columbia University, and we're going to talk about how the elite take advantage of natural disasters to enrich themselves and leave the poor poorer. Also, time permitting, I'm going to share a short discussion with Chris Hedges on the pathology of the super rich. Now, Chris is kind of unique in that he was, because of his intellect, not his money, came from working class background. he was able to go to Ivy League colleges. So he socialized with these people. He knows a lot about the rich. And indeed, they are different. And he'll tell you what makes them different, but also what makes them dangerous. Also, George Galloway discusses the Palestinian and Lebanese conflict with a BBC reporter in a way that you would never hear anyone in the United States responding to a reporter. It would just never happen. I want you to hear the nature of his discussion and his lack of respect for the reporter. Now, that's not a bad thing. It's just that he takes no prisoners here. And you'll find that historically he is correct. But people might be turned off by his intemperate nature. But listen to what he has to say. And also how the U.S. government is in bed with Monsanto. And if we have time at the end of the program, I want to have a poem by one of the greatest, if not the greatest poet ever on mysticism and spirituality, Rumi, and from Coleman Barks. It's short, it's only 3 minutes, but I thought you would appreciate it. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Here's the latest, and I'm adding this into my report, which is ever-evolving, called Death by Medicine, which proved, scientifically, using only mainstream orthodox medicine's statistics. For example, I would use the statistics of medical errors from the American College of Surgeons. How many unnecessary surgeries? How many deaths from those surgeries? How many complications from the surgeries? How many errors during surgery? So it wasn't made up. It's their figures. And we came to the number that the number one cause of death from all causes in the United States is American medicine. And the number one cause of injury. It's in the tens of millions per year. So you could look at it this way. If we have all this information, but it's leaked to us piece by piece, will anyone care? Will anyone pay attention? The answer is, I'm sure people would care if they knew, but who reads a report published in the peer-reviewed journal Anesthesiology except anesthesiologist, and what do they do with it? How about nothing? Quote, this is from the Massachusetts General Hospital. The first study to measure the incidence of medication errors and adverse drug events during the preoperative period, immediately before, during, and right after surgical procedure, has found that some sort of mistake or adverse event occurred in every second operation. And the study of more than 275 operations at Massachusetts General Hospital, which will appear in Anesthesia, the official medical journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, also found that a third of the errors resulted in adverse drug events or harm to patients. The report is being published online. Also, quote, we found that in just over 1 in 20 perioperative medical admissions result in medication error or an adverse drug event. And then it goes on to talk about what these kind of errors were. So, let me explain why that's important. So, the surgery may not have been a problem. It may have been successful. You may have needed it. And indeed, there are cases where surgery is necessary and where it's life-saving. But what happens to the high percentage of patients, I mean real high, that had completely normal hearts, and afterwards, this happened to not one but two of my friends, ended up with AFib, afibrillation, which is an irregular heartbeat which can increase your risk of dying from a heart attack or stroke. It's well known, the scientific literature is there, and yet you almost never hear this discussed. So, if you have too much anesthesia, not only can you hurt your heart, you can hurt your brain. And rarely is this discussed, and rarely then is anyone ever held accountable for this. Also, separately, all of us should be doing two types of exercise. We should be doing aerobic exercise, where we're really getting our cardiac capacity up, jogging, swimming, biking. But we should be doing resistance. Now, there's two schools of thought. One is the old school, where you do power lifting, meaning you put as much weight as you can bench press, and or lift. But that's been replaced with far more accurate information that we should do lighter weights, but greater repetitions. So let's just say that we were doing a bench press, where you're laying on a bench, or it can be an incline bench, or a bench where you're actually sitting up, and you force the weight out. Now we know you don't do it real fast. You do it slow. You're breathing slow. You're pushing slow. It's called resistance. And then when you reach your peak, meaning when your arms are extended as far as they can, you hold it for a second and slowly bring it back to your chest. The art of bringing it out slowly, back slowly, and with a lighter weight means that you will have greater bone density, which means you will help prevent thinning of the bones, osteoporosis. Big problem for people over 40. Now, how many should you do? Ideally, you should be able to do 20 repetitions, what are called reps. So let's say we were doing a press, we would press it 20 times. If you can only do 10, it's too heavy. If you could do 40, it's too light. So each one of us has a different muscle capacity, so we get that which is 20. But then after you do your 20 reps, rest for 3 minutes, then do another 20, then rest, and another 20 and rest. It's best to do 3 sets of 20s. If you're doing curls, single weight curls in each hand, do 20. If you're doing lats, lifting up the side, 20. So that's the newest, and you can help prevent bone thinning. That's good. If you watch the ball games, and depending upon your favorite team, if you like football, most of the commercials are for pizzas or beer, neither of which is good for you. And there's a difference between something not being good and something being bad by degrees. Now, if you understood that drinking beer is not good, but it's not as bad as hard alcohol like vodka, gin, bourbon, then you can say, well, I'm not drinking to get drunk. You don't have to get drunk. Just any alcohol will destroy immediately the lining of your stomach, the lining of your intestine, can cause bleeding in the intestine, can cause death of cells in your bladder. Hence, bladder enlargement, bladder cancer is much higher in people drink beer, because the tendency is people can drink a lot of beer if it's low alcohol, 2.7%, let's say, you can drink a lot of beer. So you end up with a beer belly. It's all excess calories. It does you no good at all. And then you end up with diseases, real serious diseases of the liver and of the kidneys and the brain, the heart. Now, that's the alcohol. But generally, we do 2 things negatively simultaneously, sometimes 3. We'll have French fries, we'll have potato chips, all of which are bad. They actually cause disease. But it's that meat. And the big thing now is the pizzas. Not only are they giving you more pizza, but now they've started to put the pizza, the cheese, inside what had historically been a crisp, the crust. Now they're bragging about, we're giving you more. Now they're even wrapping bacon inside the crust. So you not only get the cheesy topping with the pepperoni on top and the crust, but now you're getting bacon inside the crust. Now, some people love that and say, ah, this is it. If only they could see what happens when it goes into their stomach, intestines, and their blood. How many people would you imagine have a stroke within 3 hours of eating a pizza? How many people do you think die overnight when they eat a pizza in the evening? In the laboratory, at the Institute of Applied Biology, and in the office, which at the time was the largest alternative medical office in the United States, the Tri-State Healing Center, I saw blood workups. We actually did studies where we take a healthy person's blood before they ate, then have them drink a green juice, have them drink a fruit juice, have them drink milk, have them drink coffee, have them drink a milkshake, have them eat bean salad, then have them eat a pizza or hamburger, and you can see the destruction to their blood. Now, nobody has a stroke after one incident. Nobody develops lung cancer after smoking a pack of cigarettes or develops roast liver after drinking an alcohol beverage. But here's the problem. You don't know the magic number when you finally tip. and it is inevitable. Every single human being who ever lived in the history of the world, if they live long enough and they practice unhealthy habits, will succumb to those habits. It is inevitable. So here's the latest on why you should simply say, do I really want the consequence of processed meat? The hot dogs, the bologna, the hamburgers, the pizzas. Quote, bacon, ham, and sausages have the same cancer risk as cigarettes. According to a report by the World Health Organization, which is being published today. The World Health Organization is expected to list processed meat as a carcinogenic substance. All right. And it goes into the Encyclopedia of Carcinogens. It's bad for your health. Studies have shown that people who eat a lot of red meat tend to eat fewer plant-based foods that protect against cancer. Processed meat is made by smoking, curing, salting, or adding chemicals. Examples are salami, pastrami, bacon, sausages, hot dogs, and burgers. So, now, then the key is, if you're young, you think you're getting away with it because you don't see the immediate effects. But by the age of 40, you can't get away with anything. You're in the sun, it shows. You end up with the precancerous lesions, the aging spots on the back of your hand. By the time you're 50, you're thin. Your skin is thinning, you're seeing the veins underneath, your hair is starting to fall out, and you don't have the same energy, your mitochondria, all because we haven't done anything to change the outcome. Now, you can change the outcome. It's never too late. There's always a positive message, but you got to give it up. You can't do it both ways. And a lot of people in the health movement do it this way. And I went to a health conference recently just because someone I knew was there and said, would you come by, just say hello at the booth? And they had a booth on herbs and herbal tinctures, and I went by. And it was fine. But man, you have no idea what it's like to walk by a so-called psychic surgeon who's claiming to pull, you know, tumors out of people's body and see all this stuff. But there's a whole lot of people who believe in that, and that's their business. And it's not for me to tell them not to believe in it. It's for them to ask, should I believe in it, and what evidence do you have to challenge it? And then I see how many unhealthy people there are. It's just amazing that the most unhealthy people I ever met go to these health conferences. Then again, they should also go down to Disneyland, because I went once just to count how many people coming through the gate were overweight. Whoa. So it's about choices. And it makes a big difference when you give up the bad food and you start incorporating the good. You can change a lot of that around, but you have to want to. And not as a token. You can't say, well, I had a glass of vegetable juice and I took some vitamin C, so I guess it's okay, I can eat the garbage. No, that's just foolish. And finally, this from the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. A new study shows that more than two-thirds, that's 69%, of patients using antidepressants do not actually meet the criteria for depressive disorder. Well, but boy, they meet the criteria for making the pharmaceutical companies a lot of money and getting away with it. So I'm opposed to all pharmaceutical approaches to psychiatry. I support psychotherapy. I support all forms of quality, holistic, humanistic talk therapy. An intervention at that level. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Though you may not drive, big Cadillac. Against the white walls, TV antennas in the back.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot to share with you today. It's one of those days where I wished I had 2 hours because I have more than what's going to fit in this one program. I had someone I know who has a good background in science who called me in a panic yesterday because they had gotten a flu shot. Well, my first question is, why? Well, because, you know, we were being pressured. If your health is at stake and someone says you got to take something, you always have the right to say that you want a medical, you're going to seek a medical exemption. I would rather lose a job if it meant risking my life for worthless quackery vaccine, and that is the flu vaccine. So to my friend who made a choice that is regrettable, and now there's a whole lot that has to be done to detoxify the system, here's what you should know about the flu vaccine if you choose to use them. They're using either live as a mist or attenuated, which means kill virus, in live form in the vaccines. Thimerosal, 25 micrograms, is in there. That's enough to be neurotoxic, meaning it will absolutely, positively kill brain cells, lots of them. And it's not going to go out of your body quickly. It'll kill a lot of the cells in your spinal column, including the myelin sheath. It has aluminum salts as an adjuvant. That is a proven neurotoxin. It has egg proteins for growing the virus, known to be highly contaminated with other known and unknown viruses that pass into the vaccine following filtration. And the live flu vaccine uses chick kidney cells. They use formaldehyde, a known carcinogen. They use polysorbate 80 associated with allergic reactions, a spermicide, and you should avoid it if you have a history of cancer, seizures, problems of bleeding and clotting, stroke, heart attack, diabetes, and most commonly used in cosmetics as a surfactant and emulsifier, but it also increases skin aging. The flu vaccine for many years was a Category C drug. A few years ago, it was raised to a Category B, meaning that animal studies so far failed to demonstrate that the flu vaccine has a risk to the fetus. However, there are no adequate and well-controlled studies to show it is safe for pregnant women. Here's what the vaccine's package insert states. It can contribute. It says, quote, no flu vaccine insert package states that it is safe and effective for pregnant or nursing women. No flu vaccine insert package states the vaccine is known or not to be carcinogenic. And flu vaccines are completely strain related. This year, it's only 15% effective. Last year, it was 15% effective. They're just guessing. And studies from the Cochrane database show there is no reliable data to prove the flu vaccine is effective in children under 2 or older adults. It showed that the scientific research shows that washing hands is more effective than the vaccine. There was a Columbia University study, flu infection may be associated with later onset of psychosis and schizophrenia. The original paper warned that the flu vaccine may have this potential. This comment to the study was completely ignored by mainstream media. And a very large double-blind placebo-controlled study showed those vaccinated had a 400% increased risk of coming down with other respiratory illnesses than those that did not receive the flu vaccine. And finally, the flu vaccine has killed people. So to my friend who used poor judgment, and all of you who use no judgment and assume that what's the problem, do your homework. Then you make up your own mind. Now, here's a comment. This is from Sam Gurins of an article, America's a Bomb Waiting to Explode. I thought you would find it of interest. Quote, the United States is in decline. While not all major shocks to the system will be devastating, when the right one comes along, the outcome may be dramatic. Not all explosives are the same. We all know you have to be careful with dynamite. Best to handle it gently and not smoke while you're around it. Semtex is different. You can drop it, you can throw it, you can put it in the fire, nothing happens. Nothing until you put the right detonator into it. To me, the United States, most of the supposedly free West, increasingly looks like a truck being systematically filled with Semtex. But it's easy to counter cries of alarm with the fact that the truck is stable. Because it's true, you can hurl more boxes into the back without any real danger. But add the right detonator and you're just one click away from complete devastation. We can see how fragile the United States is now by considering just four tendencies. One, the destruction of farms and reliable food sources. The average American is a long way from food when the shops are closed. The Washington Post reports that the number of farms in the country has fallen by some 4 million, from more than 6 million in 1935 to a little under 2 million today. And according to the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, only about 2% of the U.S. population live on farms. That means that around 4.6 million people currently have the means to feed themselves. Food supply logistics are extended, sometimes stretching thousands of miles. The shops have nothing more than a few days' stock. A simple break in that supply line could clear the shops out in a day. Number two, weak economic system. The American economic system is little more than froth. The U.S. currency came off the gold standard in 1933 and severed any link with gold in 1971. Since then, the currency has been essentially linked to oil, the value of which has been protected and held together by wars. The whole world has had enough of the U.S. and its hubris, not least the people of the United States themselves, which the masses support currently going towards our efforts. Since proactive war is what keeps U.S. going, if it loses the monopoly on that front, its decline is inevitable. Fiat economies always collapse. They last an average of 37 years. By that metric, the U.S. should have already run out of gas. Once people wake up and smell the yuan, the exodus out of the dollar will be unstoppable. Three, Americans increasingly are on mind-altering drugs. According to the Scientific America, use of antidepressants among the U.S. population was up 400% in the late 2000s. Many of these drugs are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These are the type the FDA-approved narcotic lone gunmen are frequently associated with, and their psychoses often attributed to a forced or sudden withdrawal from such drugs. Pharmaceuticals are produced at centralized points by companies which themselves rely upon extended logistics systems to both produce and deliver their output. If the logistics system fails, there's no more supply. Number four, morals in decline. During the objective hardships of the 1930s, there was surprisingly little crime. People were brought up with a conception of morals and right and wrong. Frugality and prudence were prized virtues. Communities were generally fairly cohesive. Relative to then, society today is undisciplined, unrealistic, and selfish. Around 250 million shoppers participated in the Black Friday sales last year, in which around $61 billion was spent on consumer items. Stampedes and even murders are not uncommon each year, with people openly fighting each other over reduced-priced items. The goods bought in such sales tend to be non-essential, and many of them are bought on credit cards, which then have to be paid off at interest. Part of the problem in what I've outlined above is that there is little explicit tension. Sure, it is depressing, vulgar, and immoral, but it doesn't look catastrophic. It looks normal. My point is that just because the United States and many other countries organize after the same template do not look explosive doesn't mean they won't blow up. Whereas 80 years ago, we could absorb major shocks, today we cannot. In the past, people were in rural communities. They could grow food. They had real communities. They also had self-control and a conception of morality. Today, if the supply line goes down, You're stuck in a house you can't heat, surrounded by millions of FDA-approved drug addicts who are going psycho because they have run out of their juice, and people will murder their own grandmother to get a cut-price iPhone. I would argue that the right shock event or combination of shock events will detonate the explosion. Potential detonators happen all the time. Either they are contained or they are simply incompatible with the explosion or they don't go off. But that doesn't mean it's never going to happen, nor that they're not sitting on a mountain of explosives. He goes on to talk about some of these. Your thoughts on that? I'd like to hear what you think. Do you believe that America is capable of explosion, mass protests? We haven't had any thus far. Don't use Ferguson. Don't use any of those, because those were tiny, infinitesimal, completely insignificant numbers to the large majority of Americans who could have gone and didn't. So if you see everything all day, every day on the news about, 200 people or 100 people or 300 people or 1,000 people showing up, remember, we got 325 million people. So you got to ask, are we ever going to see the average person explode, go to the streets? Yes or no? Our number, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, your turn on our talk back. And while you're thinking about that, I want to share one more thing with you. This is from Finders University, Australia. Researchers at the Australia Finders University have come up with a novel solution to the problem of mercury pollution, a polymer made of industrial waste. Scientists have found a way to clean up waste with waste. The polymer is made from sulfur and limonene. Millions of tons of sulfur produced by the oil and gas industry every year, while thousands of tons of limonene, highly concentrated in orange peels, are produced by the citrus industry. Quote, not only is this new polymer good for solving the problem of mercury pollution, material scientist Justin Chalker said, but it also has the added environmental bonus of putting this waste material to good use while converting them to a form that is much easier to store, so that once the material is full, it can easily be removed and replaced. The polymer is cheap to make and efficiently removes mercury and other heavy metals from water. It can be used in line wastewater pipes or deployed in larger bodies of water to combat spills, like oil spills. And because it turns yellow when mercury is absorbed, it can be used to test for mercury contamination. And mercury is one of the most troublesome contaminants in the environment. It's heavy and quite toxic. Mercury from coal plants and mining operations leaches into the soil and sea, accumulating in fish and plants, larger and larger amounts working their way up the food chain. Easily absorbed through the skin, humans can become exposed to mercury by simply being in polluted environments, breathing polluted air, eating contaminated meat. And, of course, mercury is known to damage the brain, kidneys, lungs, and nervous system. Pregnant women and children are especially vulnerable to mercury negative health effects. Well, okay, good. And that was in a journal of chemistry. And I mentioned the professor. This is from the National Post of Canada, one of their major publications. Quote, a Montreal social scientist in the federal agency that awarded her $300,000 to study the human papillomavirus vaccine are facing criticism after the professor condemned the vaccine and called for a moratorium on its use. Concordia University's Genevieve Rail, that's R-A-I-L, also said that there is no proof that the human papillomavirus directly causes cervical cancer. Well, okay, that raised some red flags. Other experts in the related fields voiced frustration and anger at her statement. Well, I would follow the money trail and see where those other people get their research money, and also, have they done the research? Before you criticize someone, do your homework, do your research. Then you might find out she is right. I'm Gary Nall. Let's see who we have on here. We have Randy from New Jersey. Hi, Randy, your turn.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing, my brother?
These doing
good. I was just with you recently at your premiere a couple of Fridays ago. It was an excellent program. Thank you for hosting it. Hello, Gary?
I'm listening, Randy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was there. I'm sorry. My comment about whether or not the United States will have a cataclysmic event that will spur a movement. I don't know if it will happen that way. I think it will probably be a mass reaction of chaos when an event happens, and then there will be groups of people who may cluster to help. And social structures break down after that. I think there will be a segment of the population that will basically implode, and the others hopefully will have smaller groups that will have some sort of local sustainable program that they've already started that will allow them to kind of weather the storm.
Okay. Good. Randy, do you know any of those local sustainable programs around the United States? Can you name me one?
Well, only the ones that I know of are the ones that are listed in your in your Progressive Radio Network, and I know there was a community in upstate New York, and I think there's one that was doing the Earth Houses out out in the Midwest, and I think it was Arizona. But other than that, there's not a large movement of it. No.
In the last place I'd want to be, if there's a catastrophe, is up in the high plains in New Mexico or Arizona, where you can get 20 below zero. And yeah, there are a couple of those earth houses out there, and there are about 10 people living there. You got to remember, when you have a disaster, you have a breakdown in society, there is absolutely zero right now that can be done to help those people. Just something to think about. I appreciate your call, Randy. Thank you. We're going to go to our guest in a few moments. If anyone else would like to call in and share their points of view before I share mine, 888-874-4888. Here are a couple program announcements. This Wednesday evening at 8 p.m., the ALBA Human Rights Documentary Film Festival, one of the most prestigious and important film festivals in America, which shows only human rights documentaries, will be closing their film festival at 8 p.m. Wednesday evening with my Poverty Inc. And I'll be there, and then there's a socializing and award ceremony following that. But they have some outstanding documentaries. I suggest if you'd like to come, it's Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. You can call them, and I'll give you their phone number. Their phone number is 212-674-5398. 212-674-5398. It's at 799 Broadway, and the actual event where they're showing the films is at Institute Cervantes at 211 East 49th Street. Anyhow, I'll be there 8 o'clock on Wednesday night for that. That's the ALBA Human Rights Documentary Film Festival, and I've given you their number, 212-674-5398, because a lot of people say, I didn't have a chance to see the film, or I never get invited to any of these film festivals, so I've given you an opportunity. Friday, I'm having a very limited audience for a major lecture I'm doing. It's the only lecture I'm doing in the next 6 months. All my lectures are always full, and I generally don't announce them because there's no room. And this time, I'm not using a microphone because I'm filming it. So if you miss the lecture in 6 months, you'll have a chance to see it. But it's on a uniquely original theme. I call it for now Harmonizing Life. More than that, I can't tell you, but it's original. It's as original as my Life Energy lecture. Call 646-926-5422 if you want to join that. And I'm only taking 50 people who will be up front so they can hear me. Also, I'm hiring some people. I'm hiring a cook for weekends, Saturday and Sunday, who can do vegan cooking. I'm hiring, not me personally, but I'm hiring them so that they can work and make food for people. I'm hiring a research editor, someone who is very good at doing research and then editing what they research. I'm hiring a frontline producer for one of the major films I'm doing, because it's a huge film. I'll tell you how big it is. I've got about 16 people working on it. I normally have 3, and still not enough. So if you have experience contacting people, doing interviews for me to then film them when I'm around the country, that's a good thing. I'm also hiring people who would like to work days or evenings or weekends in a health food store with beauty care products and supplements, because I need good people All those jobs, you call 646-926-5422. Plus, for those of you who want free health and nutrition counseling, who keep showing up at our office, please don't. Because the only people I see are people who have a letter from their doctor that they're terminally ill. Those people I help. And for free. But I'm going to hire another person I already have. In the evenings, we have a phenomenal person, Larry, and daytime we have Celestina, both highly qualified to help you with non-life-threatening conditions. You can call 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000, and they will see you for free. I pay them a very nice living wage, so you don't have to pay them anything. It's free. It's a public service, what I do. Let's say, let's ask my guest to come on the line now. We have our guest up, and I mentioned his bio earlier today in the program. He is Professor John Mutter, M-U-T-T-E-R. He holds two professorships at Columbia University, and we're here to talk about how the elite take advantage of natural disasters to enrich themselves and leave the poor poorer. By the way, he received his degrees from universities in Melbourne and Sydney in Australia and a doctorate in marine geophysics from Columbia University. He's authored over 70 scientific articles and many popular essays. His most recent book is The Disaster Profiteers. His website is johncmutter.wordpress.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
During the past several years, climate scientists have been predicting that climate change and global warming will be bringing more severe storms and hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods and droughts and wildfires. And then there are also earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Just over the weekend, we experienced Hurricane Patricia, appeared to be the largest such storm in the eastern Pacific coast in recorded history. And on the other side of the Pacific, we witness increasing numbers of typhoons of greater severity. Therefore, we can expect to see a rise in natural calamities and disasters affecting populations, and most of them in poor or lower in economic brackets. And you've been investigating how natural disasters serve as opportunities for the rich and the powerful elite and corporations. And one example I know of from eyewitnesses is that following the Indian Ocean tsunami that devastated coastal regions of Sri Lanka, today if you visit some of those areas, large portions of the coast have been taken over and purchased by real estate speculators. And the poor fishing communities and villages and families that have lived there for centuries simply no longer exist. And the entire area is being developed for tourism and homes that only the Sri Lanka elite or foreigners can afford. So please take your time and draw this relationship between natural disasters and vulture capitalism that takes advantage of the victims of such catastrophes.
Yeah, that's a very nice summary. I feel like I don't have to say very much. Just the beginning things you said, it's true enough that most people in climate science will tell you from fairly good evidence that we would expect a more energetic atmosphere, put it that way. If you warm it up, it's going to be more energetic. And that should lead to a higher number of large cyclones, hurricanes, typhoons. They're all the same thing. It may not mean a larger number overall, but it should mean a larger number of the most intense ones, which is the ones that do the damage, the ones we should care about. So that's true enough. Earthquakes ought not change in their frequency, meaning that there shouldn't be more of them, but more people are populating areas where earthquakes happen. So when they do happen, more people will be affected. And in effect, it's almost the same thing as if there were more earthquakes in a stable place. What typically happens, and you know, you can think of any number of examples, you first hear about an event of some sort, an earthquake, a hurricane, a landslide, etc. And the news media pays a lot of attention to the tragedy, sometimes the heroics of people who are trying to help, the spectacle of things fallen down and possibly even a body to be found here and there. It's very movie-like, and they tend to follow almost a movie-like narrative. And then it moves off the front page, or it's not the first thing on the television news, and there's a slightly dead period there where you hope that people are recovering. But it doesn't take long before the media finds something else, and what they typically find is what they will call looting, whether it is or not. Whether it's common or not, they'll describe it as widespread. Whether it makes any difference to the economic losses or the economic recovery, that doesn't matter. Somehow it's the greatest sin of all time to try to acquire some provisions for yourself. And what happens is that the tone of the media coverage pivots. The victims are no longer victims, they're criminals. And the whole thinking seems to shift around to, why are we trying to help these people who are robbing us? There's a form of elite panic takes over, in which people with a lot of things that could be stolen become very protective, and that the shift goes from helping and protecting people to protecting properties, and typically the property of people of some wealth, the elite in the community. When that's all over, it's almost as if the victims who became criminalized are being punished afterwards. You gave a good example there. It depends somewhat on who says they own what property. In many countries, the state will claim they own everything and will say, okay, these lands have been blighted by tsunami, storm, whatever. They no longer can be occupied by the people who've been there, who the state will say didn't own them in the first place, and the state owned them. So they say, no, you can't go back to this place. What are we going to do with this place? Well, as you say, it tends to be acquired by people who do very different things. They're no longer itinerant farmers, surviving on farming rice. As you say, it'll be large-scale farming or hotels or something new, something more profitable, very typically owned by people who are either in the government elite or very, very close to it. And that's a very typical situation. So the poor are displaced. They're not just doing worse. They're doing, you know, relative to the rich, they're doing worse relative to what they were doing. And wealthy people tend to acquire land and other forms of capital at very, very cheap rates. And capital is always important, as Piketty says, to gain wealth without working. And hence the gap between the rich and the poor expands. It doesn't just keep things the way they were. You know, you would expect poor people to do less well because typically they live in more fragile housing, for instance. But you may think that things would be restored to the way they were. They're not. They're restored in such a way that the gap between the rich and the poor enlarges.
We saw that with Katrina. I was there.
We certainly did.
I saw formaldehyde insulation, a poor housing, but you could have a government agency, private contractor, put a tarpon up on your roof, which was meaningless, for $1,800 to $2,000. That cost them about $40. I was down there.
The other thing is, if somebody had one of those shotgun homes insured, and most of them weren't, it would be insured for a very small amount of money. Then it's wiped away, and the cost of rebuilding is nowhere near the cost of the value of what you've got it insured for. So it becomes impossible. You know, it's not exactly an upside-down mortgage. It's a value of what you insured your place for that's nowhere near the replacement cost, especially as you were told you had to put the home, you know, very high up, 8 or 10 feet, you know, so it wouldn't be flooded the next time, just to make the place even more expensive.
And, of course, then you're underwater. Let me give you an example that most people would probably say is unrelated. But in one sense, there is a stitch that binds the two. Look currently at the disaster going throughout Europe and North Africa because of Libya and because of other Tunisia and other problems of migration due mm-hmm. to civil war. Mm-hmm. However, the people in Tunisia, the civil war caused what? It caused a loss of water and loss of food. Yep. And so a lot of those people come because they don't have food. So if you say, what happened if these people ran out of water? What happened if, they, like in Bangladesh or other countries, they have too much water and are flooded? The end point is still the same. You have migrants moving from point A to point B, and there's no system right now to accommodate all these people, whether it's from a civil war or from a typhoon. They're going to end up being victims, and then you start seeing the internal pressures on countries say, we don't want any more of those people, and then you end up with a conflict. But that could be true for a disaster here in the United States also.
Yeah, so what the information is that if people experience a drought like in, a flood like in Pakistan a few years ago, and they're farmers, they will move as little distance as they can, which might be quite a ways because areas get flooded to a large extent. They wait for the floodwaters to go away and they come back and try to make things good again, and, you know, refarm their fields. With droughts and famines, the logic for going back again is not there because the area is ruined. So people are displaced a huge distance by drought and lack of food and stay displaced for longer. They're more likely to sort of give up and say, this place is just, I can't work here. A flood is different. Floods comes and goes, but drought conditions are sort of remain.
Speak a little about what a Harvard economist, Joseph Schumpeter, back in the middle part of the last century called creative destruction as being an essential principle of capitalism. And then isn't this a principle that is found through the principles of the capitalist elite from the Rockefellers to Milton Friedman and the Chicago economic boys?
So what Schumpeter, who was originally Austrian, suggested, well, what he was writing about was a critique of, a critical comparison between capitalism and Marxism. And he was observing that there were often strong business cycles. And in the down period, before you rise again and a new business is created, an old business has to be destroyed. And the example that's used all the time is that the rise of laptops, etc., desktop computers, did a lot of harm to the mainframe industry. Some big mainframe companies went out of business. Now, the way that's translated, but it's creative in the sense that the new computers were better than the old computers. So you destroy one company, you've got something better. We've all got laptops on our desks. As it's been translated into natural disasters, and I must say that Schumpeter himself never spoke of natural disasters. This is other people's translation. It says that if something bad happens, excuse me, like a storm or an earthquake, the most fragile, inefficient, old infrastructure will be destroyed. An old bridge, an old harbor, a port, you know, a school, etc. But the strong houses, the strong buildings of a certain elite will be less damaged. So you look around and you see, as happened in New Orleans, some very badly damaged areas, and you say, okay, I'll rebuild those with much stronger infrastructure that supports commerce. Not new houses, but infrastructure for commerce. So you make better roads, better bridges, better hospitals, better schools. And the notion is that that is a lasting benefit to the economy. Not just a temporary boost you get with builders rebuilding, but something that lasts sometime into the future.
It also begs the idea, why shouldn't we be doing this preventatively? Why do we need a disaster before we move to help correct bad infrastructure? Look at how bad our infrastructure is today.
Yeah, but people don't think about it until something bad happens, of course.
Well, that's too late in many cases.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the scholarship and the work and just the common sense that's in your book, The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Poorer. A great read for everyone who cares about the planet they live on. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Professor John Mutter, Mutter. And we're nearly out of time here. Just one quick announcement. For those of you at our sister station, WBAI, I know that many of you have been frustrated because there's been a delay in getting 1, 2, 10 premiums to whatever the number is, some for a year or more. We are making an effort. This office, my office, is making an effort to try to consolidate all of the outstanding premiums because many premiums are being delivered, and we commend the station for that. But for those who have not gotten all their premiums, maybe the station doesn't even have the material anymore, the premiums or the information, we will try to do all our best to get you your premiums. Call this number, 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Ask to speak with Bianca. Give her the information. You should have the premiums, however many there were, how you made your payment, and what the premiums were and when. And we will then try to get everyone who's got an outstanding premium problem, all that resolved. Okay? Thank you all. Now let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary. Last Friday, you played a clip, which was remarkable, in my opinion, about people that really didn't know anything about American history or its impact on us today. I think what impacted me most was the comments that were made, like, I don't care. It's like people don't care about history. And I wondered if you could comment on the significance of that kind of apathy in today's world.
I do not find that a negative at all. In fact, to the contrary, I think it's a positive. Not that a person is disconnected from the reality of the world we live in or that cares, because it also shows a disconnect from empathy, a disconnect from problem solving. More often than not, it's either people from a younger generation who've always had someone make excuses for their failings or be there to pay for whatever damage is done. So if they say something insensitive or racist or misogynist or just stupid, there's always someone who's going to say, well, it's not that bad. If they don't study in school but just study to pass a test and they're functionally illiterate, there'll be someone who apologizes for them, even whole systems, teachers, the system itself, because it really doesn't care about the student per se, but about its own survival. What I find remarkable is it's also true for many senior citizens who don't care. They feel that they put their time in and therefore now don't bother me. You know, I've got other things in my mind. Or the people who are in the working professional class. Yeah, I'm smart enough as an engineer, a professor, a doctor, a lawyer, a CPA. I'm smart enough to know about what's going on in the world, its history, but I just don't have the time. So you deal with it. You mean I have to deal with everything? Deal with everything. I'm dealing with one kid is, getting off heroin. Another daughter's got eating disorders. My wife's having an affair. And I've got an irresponsible hemorrhoid that doesn't seem to stay in place. So, and I got to make enough money because we keep increasing our standard of living. With the more money I make, the more pressure I'm under. So we're all stressed. You hear these in different ways. None of that is bad. Why is it not bad? Because once someone has told you they don't care, at least you have a knowledge of what not to expect from whom. it means that those who do care are the people you should be spending your time with and aligning with, because the people who care, even if they're a tiny minority, are still empowered. And just remember that empowered minority always finds the solutions in that moment, irrespective of how long it takes for that that to be manifested. So if I knew I only had 10 people that I could speak with who would be able to come into alignment with a solution, then that those 10 people could help create a food sustainability program. And it doesn't matter how many people don't care about it. What are you doing? What are you going to the country for on the weekends? That's just stupid. I mean, I just go to the store and get what I want. I order in. Yeah, you're right. And you can do that. And maybe for the rest of your life you can do it. But what happens if there's a hurricane? What happens if there's social chaos? What happens if there's a reason that that food gets interrupted in being grown? You're not going to have anything to eat. And then all your hubris and all your contempt and all your lack of ethics and morals, and all your lack of planning is going to be your karma in that moment. For those of us who want to at least plan for the future, look at the world as it should be, and are willing to address it through articles, documentaries, protests, petitions, supporting or running for offices, we're doing something positive. So my energy is on the positive. At least if people tell me, dude, I don't care about who the President of the United States was or is or what date we became a nation. I don't care about any of that. I just care about myself and how I feel. That's fine. That's their right. But it's also my right to go ahead and align with people who do care. I'm not in contempt of people who don't care. That's dividing your energy. Keep your energy focused on the positive and align yourself with those who are also positive. And even as a minority, you'll be the ones who are able to resolve issues and thrive in the midst of chaos. Does that answer the question?
It sure does. Thank you very much.
Okay, Lou Ampanesi. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.